Chapter 38. Melkor Raines pushed the last silver button of his coat through its hole, completing his prison guard disguise. He'd watched the Sheriff's Night Guard for 4 days to find just the right man with just the right physical build to match his. Cale Mays was his name, and he went on duty in 20 minutes at the Black Lock prison in the East Wall district. That is, he would have gone on duty in 20 minutes if Melkor hadn't strangled him in his bed. Melkor took stock of his disguise. The resemblance was just about perfect. To the corpse's left, a gutted goose-down pillow sprawled across the sheets, Melkor having pushed its stuffing up his shirt to serve as Cale's small but noticeable gut. Fortunately, Melkor had enough growth of facial hair to mimic Mr. Mays's unimpressive moustache. As they were both men of strong features, in the dark, bleary hours of the night, Melkor was quite sure he could pass for the man on casual observation. There were only 2 tasks for him to complete for Cretus before the impending war started, and once those were seen to fruition, he would claim his reward for his service. Aegor Geirst had promised that once Belshire was under Cretesian control, that Melkor could stretch forth his hand and pluck one of the ripe estates for his retirement. While retirement sounded dreadfully dull, the work of keeping Belshire under control would certainly afford him many more opportunities to clench his hands around an unsuspecting throat. And it was all falling into place nicely. One of the Queen's closest friends was under suspicion of treachery. The prominent Longfords, the family to whom everyone looked for leadership, sank in increasing disgrace. Any day now, the power-hungry northern lords would find that the caches of weapons and supplies they had so underhandedly paid for and hidden were nowhere to be found. And now that Justice Page had arrived in the sheriff's office, more names would be dragged through the mire of scandal and intrigue. The long-fermenting plan really couldn't have gone much better. While the revelations contained in the ledgers from Hightower had come a bit too soon, the ensuing chaos was quite satisfying. Day by day, Belshire frayed more and more. Still, the people did not think that Cretus posed much of a threat. Melkor couldn't help but grin. Which northern noble would do the honourable thing and admit that their carefully hoarded weapons were likely in the hands of their enemies? He checked Mr. Mays's tarnished watch. Time to go. After another check of his disguise, Melkor blew out the lantern, darkness hiding the dead man's face, which stared up at the ceiling from his bed. Melkor stepped outside the modest apartment and into a beautiful summer night. Belshire really was a fine city. Crete, while an efficient and functional place, possessed little variety or character, consisting of a mass of long rectangular buildings with straight lines on perfectly straight streets on a perfectly regular grid, no slums, no rich quarter, no mystery, no danger. Belshire, however, teemed with all manner of people, from the most dissolute of drunks to the most sober of abstainers. One could become anyone in Belshire and blend in somewhere. After he had killed Eutychus Longford in pretended vengeance for Horace Clout, Queen Philippa had him escorted from Belshire. Melkor had simply waited for the cloak of night and sneaked back into the city. A quick throttling of a drunkard in an alley provided him with new clothes and no questions. The guard he had just killed lived in the Bristol Market district, a definite upgrade from the hovel Melkor had inhabited as a drunk in the Crooks. It was convenient to Eastgate and the Black Lock prison, where the guard whose persona he had assumed had employment standing sentry at the rear entrance of the building. It was the prison where the 2 clerks from Hightower were sequestered awaiting the trial of Lady Hightower. Their ham-fisted attempt to recover the ledgers had clued Baron Carver into the ledger's importance, and because of the Baron, the conspirators had to accelerate their plans. But the 2 clerks had served their purpose. Their testimonies were recorded, but since the Queen was Lady Hightower's special friend, Melkor suspected she would find a way to save her. Tonight he would ensure that the trial would end with Lady Hightower drowning, finishing the task Horace Clout had originally set him to. Find the Queen's successor and kill him. Or her. Having the Lord High Sheriff's executioner do the killing for him would be a masterstroke. Queen Philippa's choice of her widowed friend as successor was an odd one, however. Ambassador Clout and Melkor himself had prognosticated that Duke Longford or Lord Ember would be tapped to rule the nation. Lady Hightower was certainly attractive, independent and well-liked, but strong enough to take over Bitter March. The only strange part of the document he uncovered in the vaults of the Flame Cathedral was that if she ever married, the throne would pass to her husband. What sane woman would give up her power and influence for a marriage? Bitter Marchions often made little sense, however. He continued his walk down the lane, relaxing his limbs and his gait to appear at ease in another man's clothing. The moral pretensions of the more affluent East Gate denizens provided empty streets at the late hours of the night. Decent people didn't roam around in the dark. One might encounter a drunk merchant or a mistress sneaking home, but tonight his honed senses found no noise or movement to bring him alarm. At precisely 2 minutes to midnight, he arrived at the prison wall, an 8-foot affair crowned with black iron spikes pointing to the sky. The building, windows mostly dark, sat like a mountain behind the wall, a hulking 3-story edifice made entirely from brick. Narrow windows marked the cells on the top 2 floors, and wider windows marked the offices on the bottom. Lamps burned at the front of the entrance and the lesser-used back door. Melkor avoided the front. A brace of guards manned the guardhouse, and while Melkor was confident in his disguise, he certainly couldn't pass for Mr. Mays if trapped in a conversation. The wooden back gate at the rear of the prison was only opened to allow in food and supplies for the prisoners, and was as wide as 2 wagons. It reached as high as the walls to either side and was painted black, the spikes on top poking skyward. The designers probably thought the menacing hardware a deterrent to anyone thinking of climbing over. What it really provided was something for someone athletic to grab onto after a jump. Melkor put his eye to a crack in the gate, finding the guard Mr. Mays was to relieve, patrolling the backyard lethargically, yawning into the night. As the guard tracked south, Melkor chose a section of the wall next to the gate and made his jump with the assistance of a mortar crack. Each of his hands clutched a spike until the one in his right hand pulled away from the mortar used to secure it. Bits of dust and debris showered his face and stuck in his eyes. Clinging by one hand, he tossed it over the wall into the soft grass of the yard, rather than let it drop noisily to the cobblestones at his feet. Blinking to clear his eyes, he grabbed the next spike over and pulled himself up, the vacated spike, providing a convenient platform to lift himself up onto and then jump from. He was in. A quick swat to his hair and uniform cleared the chunks of mortar and dust. He hurried to his post before the other guard could circle back around on his patrol route. Melkor stood diligently at attention just outside the door, as if he had just arrived for his shift. When the guard did return, Melkor moved to keep the lantern light in the other man's eyes. The guard stopped and yawned.
"About time," he said, throwing a sleepy look at his replacement and unclipping a keyring from his belt. "The family's all asleep in there. See you tomorrow."
He tossed the keys up and Melkor caught them. He knew that Mr. Mays had a deep voice, so Melkor bid the retiring guard,
"Good evening,"
in his best Bitter Marchian accent. The guard waved and left, making his way toward the front gate. Melkor waited for him to clear the yard, leaning with his upper back against the prison wall like Mr. Mays would do. He had to hurry before some bored guard discovered him and decided to strike up a conversation. So once the exiting guard was out of sight around the corner, Melkor turned to the door, inserted the worn iron key into the lock, and let himself in. The interior of the prison reminded him of buildings in Cretus. Long hallways, regular doors, ascetic appointments. Nothing was frivolous or out of place, and everything was clean, especially for a prison. The white plaster walls reflected a weak moonlight coming in through the larger windows of the lower level. Melkor turned left, unlocking a gate to the stairwell that led up to the second level where a terrified Mr. Mays had told him the steward and clerk were sequestered. Rooms 24 and 25. The gate door swung open without even the hint of a squeal. The High Sheriff ran a tight operation. Once inside, Melkor shut the gate but didn't lock it. He would need to get out quickly. Taking the steps 2 at a time, he arrived on the second floor, finding a single lantern burning in the middle of the long corridor, cell doors on the left and right. Rooms 24 and 25 waited near the stairwell. Melkor jogged down the wooden floor, boards creaking at his passing, and retrieved the lantern from its hook. Room 24 was first. Melkor unlocked it and pushed the handle, holding the lantern in front of him. The cell doors had a voice, and the creaking woke the tenant. The steward of Hightower, Mr. Barles, sat up in his bed and shielded his eyes with his hand.
"What's the meaning of this?" he said,
voice clogged with sleep. Melkor pulled one of his pistols from his belt and shot him clean through the heart. The report echoed through the building, muffled yells of surprise erupting down the hall. The steward collapsed onto his mattress without a groan. Now that the alarm was raised, Melkor knew speed was essential. He turned to room 25 across the hall and unlocked it, kicking open the door violently. The head clerk, Mr. Cranton, was on his feet, sock cap dangling in his face. Melkor pulled his second pistol and aimed it at the man's chest, though his victim was too blinded to see it.
"Lady Hightower sends her greetings, traitor," Melkor growled.
He aimed the pistol high and to the right of the man's heart. This clerk would need to testify in court that Lady Hightower had, at last, sent an assassin to finish him off. He took the shot, red blooming on the long night robes of his target. The clerk screamed in agony and collapsed on his bed. Tossing both pistols aside, Melkor jumped down the stairs three at a time. Footsteps raced down the hallway to his left as he opened the stairwell gate. Three prison officers ran toward him, a single lantern casting wild shadows against the wall.
"A gun's been fired on the second floor,"
Melkor yelled, hoping the trio would only see the uniform.
"I'll fetch the warden."
It worked. Melkor yanked open the exterior door and bolted into the courtyard without any opposition whatsoever. With a quick bound and a pull, he was over the wall and back into the dark avenues of Belshire. Exhaling and straightening his coat, Melkor slowed his pace and wandered away toward the crooks. With an assassination attempt to add to an already tall pile of damning evidence, Lady Arianne Hightower's judge would have a much easier time bringing her trial and her life to a swift conclusion. Only one task remained to him now: end the life of the ancient queen. For that he would need to kill another man, and commandeer another costume. Baron Olivan Longford waited for his brother, the Duke, in the alley by the Tewbury Gentlemen's Club. The hour was late, but at the back entrance of the club there were still plenty of people passing in and out to avoid the scandal that might erupt should they leave through the front. The gentlemen and their mistresses preferred a more clandestine exit. Olivan smoked a pipe, savouring the fragrant and soothing tobacco from the south, and for once he had some nerves to settle. After his encounter with Baron Carver and the tipsy Mr. Goodwin, he had felt fear. Not of the two men, of course, they were nothing. He feared because he'd enjoyed the memory of whacking his wife's latest bird against the tree and throwing it in the river. The voice forbade such pleasure in killing. He had thought the act stoically accomplished, but a fleeting burst of joy at seeing the annoying squawker dead rose within him whenever he thought back on the incident. Just as quickly as the joy came, it turned to anxiety. He had gone against the strictures the voice had tried to inculcate in him, and now the punishment had come. The voice had instructed him to return to the beginning of his journey to enlightenment by crushing more peacock beetles, reinforcing old lessons by forcing him to root in the dirt for hours. His last act of penance was to kill his wife, though if the voice thought that would cause him any feeling of enjoyment or regret, it was dreadfully mistaken. He had contemplated the act so frequently that doing it came as unconsciously as sucking in pipe smoke. Her body he had hidden away in his cave, where no one would find it. Still, thanks to Baron Carver and the weak-willed Justice Page, he was now a fugitive in Bittermarch. It bothered him little. The voice's final lesson loomed close now. The eternal flame would sputter and die, just like the tongues of any other fire when met with a deluge, and his deluge would be no ordinary flood. Just a quick trip back to Longford and his cave, and all would be ready. The door of the club creaked open and the tall silhouette of his brother, Duke Melbourne Longford, stepped out, eyes searching the shadows cast by the lantern hanging by the door.
"Over here," Olivan prompted.
The Duke was ever the gentleman. Even when walking in a back alley under the cover of night, his posture was erect, his demeanour commanding and in control. Olivan wondered why the voice had not chosen his brother for its work instead. If the Duke could act so unperturbed after his oldest son precipitated a war and was stabbed to death, then surely the man had a steady grip on his emotions. But as the Duke neared, Olivan retracted his assessment. The face was worn, eyes haunted and hateful. The Duke wasn't sleeping well. While his shoulders might be up and back, his spirit slumped in weariness. The Duke stared at him for a moment before speaking.
"How could you let yourself be discovered, Olivan? The plan is in shambles. The plot is going to be exposed in open court tomorrow. Names will be named."
"Let myself be discovered, brother?" Olivan spat back. "It is Justice Page that has undone this scheme. Apparently Baron Carver and Mr. Goodwin are quite persuasive."
"And how did he escape your grasp?"
the Duke demanded, tone sharp.
The men I sent chased them into the royal wood and were slaughtered by beasts. Terror birds, by the looks of it. Mr. Goodwin and Mr. Page escaped, though no one's seen anything of Baron Carver since.
Hands behind his back, the Duke paced back and forth for a few moments, and Olivan puffed at his pipe while he waited for his brother to collect his thoughts.
This could not have come at a worse time, the Duke lamented. These accusations against our family, your implication in the whole affair, and my son's actions, they have all cast a long shadow across the House of Longford.
Olivan nodded.
True. But should you ride in to rescue Belshire in its hour of need, that will certainly dispel any ill will these events might dredge up. I assume you have been more careful about your ledgers than those fools at High Tower.
Of course, Duke Longford answered. But you know as well as I that proof is hardly needed in the court of public opinion. With the names of so many northern lords rolling off of Justice Page's lips, it will be quite clear to anyone what is at work here. The worst of it is they think we're arming Cretus.
Have you secured the weapons? Olivan asked. Do you have hands to hold them?
I have dispatched men to gather them, the Duke explained. I'm only glad that your man, Dales, was it, was never caught. He knows where all of the stockpiles are.
Olivan grunted in agreement, biting his pipe to stifle a smile. His brother had a rude awakening in store. The stockpiles had been moved, not a week ago, into the hands of the very Cretesians from whom the Duke was planning to save Bittermarch. Olivan dutifully played along, acting the conspirator with his brother and the useful Melkor Rains. All Olivan wanted was more death, to teach the voices lessons on the finality and futility of life. Who ruled in Bittermarch was hardly his concern. Olivan removed the pipe from his mouth and tapped it out on the wall.
Will you attend Lady Hightower's trial tomorrow?
The Duke snorted in his high-class way.
Hardly. I cannot afford to be associated with that woman, though she was dreadfully close to being my daughter-in-law. I will wait for news from a discreet distance.
Very wise, Olivan said. I am going to leave Belshire for a while until things are a little more friendly to our family.
The Duke nodded.
That is best. Give my regards to the Baroness.
Olivan nodded and they parted ways. A quick trip to the cave near the river would return him to the mighty form of Dales. Then at last he would begin the journey he had waited for since the voice had first found him, to carry the primal water to its natural enemy.